And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I am Romy Reyes.
How is it going?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing great. I'm going to jump right into this real quick. We can catch up a little bit, but I realize that every time I edit one of our episodes that it takes us like 10, 15 minutes to say what we're talking about. So I'm going to not leave our listeners in suspense this time or make myself edit more than I need to. Today, we are talking about The Princess Bride. Many people might not realize mm-hmm. that The Princess Bride is actually originally a novel.
Correct.
Did you know that before I recommended this?
I actually did not until we started talking about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
See?
I was one of those people.
I think I did not know it was made into a movie from a book until I stumbled upon it like at Barnes & Noble or something.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, is this the novelization or...
So you knew nothing of the author at the time?
No, I did not. But not being a product of the 60s, I was not familiar with...
70s.
I was not familiar with William Goldman.
Okay, yeah.
He said as he pulled up his phone to double-check the name. Many people, I was surprised by how many people actually have never heard or seen of the movie.
Younger people, probably.
Yeah.
I'm assuming. Okay.
Most of them are younger.
Yeah.
They didn't grow up a blockbuster like we did.
Yes.
All right, so how were you first exposed to The Princess Bride?
So I want to say the first time I was exposed was back in high school. I don't remember as a child. It's possible that it aired on one of the rerun movies on Sunday afternoon, and I might have sat and watched it.
The Sunday night movie.
Yeah, pretty much. And I don't remember.
Princess Bride.
It's highly possible, but I don't remember. And I was trying to think back, when did I first see it? I actually don't remember. Like, it's such a part of growing up in life. I'm pretty sure it was around high school. But
I just always remember being
earlier.
One of those movies we always rented.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I think if I did see it as a kid, I don't think we sat and watched it. I think it was one of those things where I was doing my stuff as it was on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some movies you just grow up with and it's just always there.
Yeah. Like The Neverending Story.
The Neverending Story. I got a fun story about that one. I don't think my sister listens to my podcast, so I don't care. My parents do, so they can tell her. We were watching Stranger Things, and in the second season, or third season, I think, one of the kids, he talks about how he's dating this girl from camp.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody believes that he's actually dating this girl. It's kind of like the My Girlfriend Lives in Canada thing.
Yeah.
And then by the end of the season, you realize she actually is real. And they're actually dating long distance. And apparently their couple thing is the song Neverending Story,
okay.
The theme to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a part in it. It's totally forced. It's like my least favorite part of it. It's cute, but it's stupid.
Yeah.
Where she, in order to help him, she like makes him sing the song with her.
That's funny.
And I'm just like, okay, why? Anyway, but at one point I played the original version to that song.
Yeah.
And my sister's like, this is such a weird version. What is this? I'm like, the original? She's like, what do you mean? I was like, this is the original 80s version. She's like, it was a real song? I was like, yes. And she's like, I thought they just made it up for the show.
That's
like,
funny.
Nope. We have failed you.
I think it's actually making the rounds on social media right now.
Sure.
The music video.
Oh, okay. I mean, we could do that book at some point because The Neverending Story was a book.
Wow, okay. That I did not know either.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
So is Labyrinth a book too?
No. Well, they made it into a book after.
Okay, but
that's one of the things I like about Labyrinth is Labyrinth is an original story. And that doesn't happen a lot in Hollywood.
Especially today.
Oh, no. Definitely not now.
All right. So... When was the first time you were exposed?
Oh, I don't even know. I just grew up with it.
Okay.
It was just something that periodically we rented, and I don't really remember the first time. I just remember it just being there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's funny in watching it, because we watched it not too long ago, and how much you forget when time goes by. I mean, I saw it maybe two years ago, and I forgot the whole opening scene. I mean...
Really?
Yeah.
You forgot the whole, like, framing device with the grandpa and the...
No, that part I remembered. It was more where you actually see her young, them young.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Buttercup and Wesley on the farm.
Because I was reading the book, and I'm like, I don't remember this from the movie. They skipped all of it. It begins right when she's kidnapped. And then we're watching the movie. I'm like, oh, I guess my
the
brain...
The movie does cut down a lot as you have to, but yeah.
Significantly. But we'll get to that later.
Anyway. So, The Princess Bride. The original book is called The Princess Bride, S. Morgenstern's classic tale of true love and high adventure, the quote-unquote good parts version. It's a 1973 fantasy romance novel by American writer William Goldman. The book combines elements of comedy, adventure, fantasy, drama, romance, and fairy tale. And some say satire. It is metafictionally presented as an abridgment of a longer work by the fictional S. Morgenstern, and Goldman's commentary asides are constant throughout.
So, real quickly, prior, just for our listeners, prior to reading this, I didn't realize the book was a fictional abridgment, and so he kept on telling me to get the unabridged version.
I know.
And so I actually spent some time online looking for the unabridged version, and I'm like, nobody has an unabridged version. And then I finally realized, so I fell for it.
Oh, that's great. There are unabridged audiobook versions. There are abridged audiobook versions.
Yeah, I saw that. And I ended up reading this one out loud. To my wife.
You were so frustrated, weren't you?
Yes.
Like, I can't find the unabridged version.
It was frustrating. I finally was like, is there? Is there not? The websites I was going to were not explaining things. So finally, I think once I started reading it, I realized I get it now.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up with the movie first, and you clearly did too, because this is your first time reading the book.
Yeah.
When I first read it, I was really excited to read it, but I was deeply confused.
Why is that?
Because I was similar to you in that I thought I found like an abridged version.
Oh.
And so I was trying to find the original version.
Yeah.
And I was really confused by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, is this just me? Am I losing it? Like,
that's funny.
Like, what's happening? And when you read it, he's so committed to the story. We should tell our listeners, the book and the movie are very similar, and yet they're very different. At the same time.
Yeah.
In the book, the first section of the novel is Goldman, literally himself, talking about his own life, but it's fictionalized.
Yeah.
And so he talks about having like a son who he never actually had. And then he talks about like an overbearing, like frustrating wife, but that's not the case at all. And so he made up this fictional life about himself that plays into the story. And in his book, he finds out that the supposed historical tale that his father had told him growing up, that is supposed to be S. Morgenstern's The Princess Bride, was actually only the good parts version that his father was telling him. And so his father was like taking out the boring parts from the book and only keeping the really good parts. And the only way that the fictional Goldman finds out about this is because he tells his son to read the book, and the son's like, I couldn't do it, Dad. It's so boring. And he's like, what? It's so good. And then he picked up a copy, and he's like, he found the copy, and he's like, oh, I don't remember any of this. And so the book that we read is supposed to be Goldman abridging the book to the good parts only. And so there are moments in it where he will have commentary about, oh, and then my dad would come in and say things to me like, the sharks don't eat her, don't worry, you'll be fine, or things like that.
Yeah. And it's well done. It took a little getting used to in the beginning, and it was interesting to read his, what would you call it? What is that called where he inserts himself into his narrative, into the story?
The metafictional?
Well, yeah, I was trying to think of the technical term for it, but I know what I'm thinking of, because he doesn't really interject himself more towards the end, but I feel like the William Goldman in the beginning is very kind of different to the one towards the end, and definitely. Did you read the supposed sequel?
Oh, you're talking about Buttercup's Baby?
Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Yeah, like basically I did not like him. You know, he was a jerk in some ways, like kind of nihilistic jerk in the intro.
I was doing a lot of research mainly on YouTube, as I do, and one analysis was describing the difference between the book and the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because Goldman, interestingly enough, was also a screenwriter.
Yes.
And so he actually wrote the screenplay for his own book.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think to his credit, he does a great job of writing the screenplay for it because mm-hmm. he is not faithful to his book because he knows that the medium is different. And so he has to change things because it's visual and people are more... In a movie, people don't like... there to not be a happy ending.
Yeah.
And things like that. Like people can walk away from a book with a book having a lackluster mm-hmm. ending and being okay with it. Whereas if you go to a movie theater, you really want a happy ending for the most part and
correct.
Things like that. And so like he kind of made some changes for the screenplay, which we'll talk about. But when the analysis I was watching, it was talking about how I think the video is called An Inconceivable Adaptation. And he was talking about how in the story, in the original book, it focuses a lot on the idea that life is not fair.
Yeah.
And how you can want something, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have it. Or you can work hard for something, but then life's great irony is that you can work really hard for something and then it disappears or mm-hmm. you couldn't get it or things like that.
Or it all falls apart at the end.
Yeah. And so it plays into that whole framework he does with... like him and his father reading the book to him.
Yeah.
But then also his relationship with his wife and his fictional wife and his son and things like that. Because in the book, his fictional father is from Florin, mm-hmm. which is not a real kingdom, but it was made up for this.
Yeah.
He really commits.
He did. No, it was well done. I'm not going to, you know, despite how he came across in the intro, it was well done.
It was well done enough that I actually Googled him like, was Florin a real country? But it's interesting because he plays into our preconceived conceptions of a fairy tale and mm-hmm. storytelling and like what that means. And so sometimes he kind of tips it on its head. And so he'll present something to you that is not what you expected. Like he might build up to something and then kind of pulls the carpet from under your feet a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of my favorite moments in it is obviously like we're going to say there's spoilers to anything we talk about on this podcast, but getting that out of the way, there's a scene in the book where it's Fezzik and Inigo go into the prince's zoo of death on the castle grounds.
Which is different than the movie.
Yes. And they had to change things for the movie. They turned it into the Pit of Despair mainly because they didn't have enough money to do everything. So they had to simplify.
The book part, that was something that had they had the money, it would have been a cool sequence. But
well,
it
and today, you know, it would just be all CGI. But.
Yeah.
But there's a scene in that where... there's a scene in the book where they're in the zoo of death and you've gone past all of these horrible creatures that they've had to fight off, right? Mm-hmm. And every layer down they go before they get to Wesley, it just gets worse and worse. And it's like the more deadly. And they like just finished all these bats. They just fought off a snake and all these things. And they go to a room and they can see the door ahead of them. And Goldman as the fake Morgan Stern writes that there is like this horribly deadly spider on the back of the door
mm-hmm.
on the like right underneath the doorknob, and it will attack if the doorknob is moved.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like building up and building it up, and then like Fezzik freaks out because of like what is going to be on the other side of the door, that he just like barges through the door and then the spider like accidentally gets stepped on.
Yeah.
And it's like all this buildup and then nothing.
Yeah.
So he'll do things like that where like he definitely plays into like our ideas of storytelling and then he'll just mess with you, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, I think the book was well done. I think it took a little while to get used to. However, okay, so I'll put it this way. His interjections at the beginning I didn't care for. I thought they just got annoying.
Sure.
And but this is when he's talking about Florence's history and about the most beautiful women in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it wasn't until we got actually into the story with Buttercup that it started getting really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because in the book, because it's in book form,
mm-hmm.
he can go a lot more in depth on different things.
Yeah.
And then he, quote unquote, cuts out a bunch of things.
Yeah.
That don't need to be talked about. He says one whole chapter about how the queen packed her luggage and, you know, stuff like that.
And that I did appreciate, though. The
I know you
exposition.
Would.
No, not the cut parts.
I knew you would like the whole, like, detailed about.
Because it was cool in watching the movie to think, like, since it was the same guy who did it, mm-hmm. you kind of now more or less know the backstory of Fezzik and where he came from and Inigo and
it's,
stuff like
it's
that.
It's funny because the movie, we don't need to go too much right now into the differences yet, but it's funny how in the movie it seems like, in some ways, it takes itself more seriously.
Yeah.
Because it didn't have the same voice that the book has.
Yeah.
In a lot of
ways.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the book, there'll be moments where they'll say things like, Wesley left to go earn his fortune in America. And it says, this was shortly after the founding of America, after the discovery of America, but before blah, blah, blah. Like, he'll say, the woman wore all the most fashionable gowns from Paris. This was after the introduction of Paris, but before Paris, blah blah blah.
I think that's where I was getting a little annoyed with this.
He did that way too much in the beginning.
Yeah.
After a while, I was like, okay, I get it, but he'll do things like that where it's clearly comedic, and
I almost feel like I could see him getting a flow as he wrote.
Maybe
that's kind of what I felt.
Well, I read on Wikipedia, which you know is completely accurate. Let me find it. Apparently, one of the reasons why he ended up writing the book the way he did, with like the fictionalized version of himself
mm-hmm.
and stuff, is because he actually was writing it relatively straight as a fantasy.
Oh, okay.
He had asked his daughters randomly one day, hey, what would you like in a story if I could write you anything?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, one of his daughters said, I want a story about a princess. And the other said, I want a story about a bride. And he's like, great, it's the princess bride.
That works.
Apparently he wrote the first chapter and he goes really in depth on Florin and about Buttercup and stuff. But then he started writing the second chapter called The Groom, about Humperdinck and stuff. And he just like couldn't keep writing. Like, he kind of lost it. And he didn't really like it anymore. And so then he somehow came, like, transitioned and made that into the idea of, oh, what if I'm only writing the good parts?
Oh.
And so then he got the idea of making it into like a fake abridged version.
Interesting.
And so then he could cut out things he didn't want to write about.
Huh.
And so that's why The Groom is actually like the shortest chapter in the book. Because he just didn't really want to write about Humperdinck.
I think it was like 3 page. It was really short. Yeah.
But then he has like a whole section about all the things he says he cuts out of it.
Yeah. And I liked how he was able to do that, because there were a couple times when he was able to further the story through his interjections, basically, mm-hmm. and it didn't get, you know.
Yeah, it definitely explains things that are not explained in the movie that didn't really need to be explained, but, you know, some people like that.
It's for those of us who like
There's the one exposition. Section. Anyway, I should give a quick plot summary, but
yeah,
real quick before we go further.
Mm-hmm.
So I already explained the kind of framework of it. It's the fake Goldman writing the abridged version of S. Morgenstern's novel, The Princess Bride, and mainly for his son, but then other people as well,
mm-hmm.
so that they can enjoy it like he enjoyed it from when his father read it to him. So that's the framework. He cuts in every once in a while. It's at the beginning, it's at the end. And the actual fantasy story is set in kind of like a medieval Renaissance era world. And there's a young woman named Buttercup who lives on a farm in the country of Florin. She bosses her poor servant, Wesley. Every time she demands something of him, he says, as you wish. And eventually she realizes the true meaning of this is, I love you. Buttercup and Wesley end up declaring their love for each other, and he goes off to pursue his own fortune so that they can marry. And what ends up happening is he is captured by the dread pirate Roberts, who never takes prisoners, and so he is presumed dead. and she becomes deeply depressed, and apparently she becomes like one of the most beautiful people in the kingdom because she had fallen in love with Wesley and like started taking care of herself.
Yeah.
And the prince becomes aware of her beauty, and he knows that he needs to marry because his father is, the king is dying, and that was actually really funny. The whole bits about the father like trying to say things and nobody can understand him, and then the queen Bella would be like, oh, he said this, and it was like nothing at all like what he said.
Yeah.
But the prince goes to Buttercup and says that he wants to marry her, and she doesn't want to because she doesn't love him and she'll never love again. And he says, well, you don't need to love me to marry me. And so she's like, well, fine. So she agrees, because otherwise she'll die, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to marry him. She's introduced to everybody, and everyone in the kingdom falls in love with her. And one day when she's riding her horse, which gives her the only consolation anymore, she is kidnapped by three people. Vizzini, the mastermind, Inigo Montoya, who is the Spanish swordsman, and then Fezzik, who is the giant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very gentle, very childlike. And of course, Inigo Montoya is out for revenge to find the six-fingered man who killed his father, who came after demanding a sword and refused to pay for it. I'm boiling down a lot.
Yeah.
So she wakes up, and there's a brief stint where she jumps overboard and into shark-infested waters. She's brought back on board, and then they have to climb the cliffs of insanity. And they're being chased by a man in a mask. And what ends up happening is the man in black, he has an epic duel with Inigo, and he defeats Inigo, but he leaves him alive because he respects him and all he's done. Then he goes and he has to fight off the giant, which mm-hmm. he's able to do because the giant is used to fighting multiple people instead of just one. He has to have a battle of wits with
Vizzini.
Thank you, Vizzini. Mm-hmm. And so he takes Buttercup, and he's very aggressive with her in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's very angry and with her, and like calls her like unfaithful and stuff. And then she ends up realizing, after she pushes him down into a ravine, that it's actually Wesley, because he screams back to her, as you wish.
Mm-hmm.
All this time they're being chased by the prince and his people, who think that she's been kidnapped by the neighboring kingdom of Gildor. To evade the prince and everybody, they go into the fire swamp, which has these horrific things like the ROUSs, the rodents of unusual sizes, and the lightning sand and the bursts of flames and things. They make it out, which is astonishing, and almost nobody's able to do that. And they're captured by the prince
mm-hmm.
and Count Rugen, who you find out has six fingers, so you know it's the man that Inigo's looking for. And instead of, essentially in the book, it's like instead of dying with him, she tells and it was more like she was afraid mm-hmm. in the book.
Yeah.
Buttercup says, I will go with you. Just, you know, like, don't kill us.
Yeah.
And she says, I'd rather be alive, essentially. Mm-hmm. In the book, it's much more of like a mistake, and it's a lot less of her like protecting him, it seemed like. But we don't need to go too much into that yet.
Yeah, I know. I was
I just thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're coming from the movie, you know? So she goes to marry Prince Humperdinck. There's a brief moment where he writes as if she already married the prince and the king had died, and
mm-hmm.
she's confronted by this old hag who says that you left your love in the fire swamp and you forsook him and all these things. And then her nightmares get really crazy. Like, she has a baby, and the baby, like, hates her,
yeah,
and the baby dies, and all these things.
Yeah, those were definitely graphic.
Yeah, a little bit. Yes. Yeah, they were hard to get through a little bit. And she ends up going and telling the prince that she can't marry him. She loves Wesley.
Yeah.
And the prince promises to go send his four fastest ships in each direction to go look for him.
Mm-hmm.
But we already know that the prince has actually imprisoned him in the Zoo of Death with Count Rugen, who has created the machine,
mm-hmm.
which yeah. can suck life out of a person. And it's horribly painful, apparently. And then we go back to Fezzik and mm-hmm. Inigo Montoya,
yeah.
who come across each other again. Fezzik's on the brute squad,
mm-hmm.
and he and the rest of the people are sent out to get rid of all the thieves in the thieves' quarter because the prince is pretending that the agents of Gildor are being sent out to murder the princess.
Correct.
And you find out that the prince is actually planning to assassinate her himself so that he can start a war with Gildor.
Mm-hmm.
And he originally was the one who hired Visini to have her killed.
Yes.
And so he plans to murder her after they are married. And it's like his country's like 500th anniversary or something like that. So what ends up happening is Buttercup kind of finds out that the prince lied, and she gets angry at him and like belittles him, and then he gets angry, and so then he goes and he basically kills Wesley.
Yeah, in his anger.
Right. He boosts the machine up to the highest number. Fezzik and Inigo go to the Zoo of Death, fight off all the creatures, and they go to rescue Wesley, and he's already dead. And so they need a miracle, so they take him to go see Miracle Max, who's kind of like a sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
And they go there, and I love how in the book it talks about how every good miracle man needs to have a witch who works for him.
Yeah.
And so he just has his wife pretend to be the witch. Which always made me laugh, because in the movie I was always confused by that part.
Yeah.
Because in the movie she just appears and he's like, "Get back, you witch." And she's like, "I'm not a witch, I'm your wife." But in the book, it's really straightforward. He makes a pill that brings him back to life. But in the book, it's only for like an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not even sure that it'll work.
Actually, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting. So essentially, the idea is like Wesley would die again in the book.
That's it was a little more confusing there. I wasn't sure if he was dying again completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? He wasn't dying again. It was that basically he would have 45 minutes of almost regular strength, and then he would go back to near death and have to be... I remember there was actually a paragraph or something
slowly over months.
Months.
It was confusing, though.
Yeah.
Because at one point it sounded like he would die again.
Yeah.
It almost seemed like he was trying to figure it out.
Yeah, no... They kind of were, the Mad Max and his wife, mm-hmm, were kind of like skeptical as to whether it was going to work or not.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, they storm the castle. There's the funny bit where the priest has a speech impediment in the book. And they're married in the book. Like, they're actually married in the book. Did you catch that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They actually get married. There's a whole bit where Wesley's like, "Well, we can settle that real quickly by just killing you." And, you know, and Wesley gathers his strength, and he prevents Buttercup from killing herself, and he threatens Humperdinck, who essentially like surrenders, and Inigo goes to go kill Count Rugen, and he says, of course, the immortal words, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You've killed my father. Prepare to die."
Which anyone who's ever seen the movie knows that.
Yes. Yeah. And then as I was saying, I was like, I better get this right because everybody knows it. And Fezzik appears with a bunch of white horses they can all escape on. And in the book, it's there's this bit where it says, "And it ends." And then it's like, but as a kid, I wanted to know, is there more? It ends really abruptly, and the father didn't want to tell him. And then he figures out, okay, it actually ends like... But then that was before, like, their one horse threw a shoe, and it was like Inigo's stitches opened up, and mm-hmm, all these things. And so it's very ironic in the end, where it's like, it's not really a happy ending.
Yeah, it's...
Like, it is, but it isn't.
That's what I was saying about the nihilism. Mm-hmm. It was almost like, what perspective do you want? In fact, there's something in the back of my mind that I want to say... maybe a TV show or something that ended similar to that, you know, where it's like you have the ending and then they were like, they kind of had the happy ending at mm-hmm. the end.
When I was looking at that one analysis, the mm-hmm. Inconceivable adaptation one.
Yeah.
It was in that, and it was a couple other things. They were talking about how it seemed like Goldman was really trying to be satirical when it comes to like fairy tales, mm-hmm. but then also just storytelling.
Okay.
And so he didn't want to give readers or audiences, for this story specifically, he didn't want to give them what they expected.
Okay.
He wanted to kind of play on those expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of times in the story where, like, you know, in a lot of old stories that get passed down, like, it almost become like stock characters, or like, mm-hmm. the plot is in some ways like people expect certain things.
Yeah.
And so, like, in this one, the prince is the bad guy,
mm-hmm.
which you, in most stories, the prince is not. And the princess makes bad decisions and things, but then she's redeemed. But, and like, the hero dies, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of things where, like, he plays with your expectations and he's being a little ironic and comedic while doing it. But it works well in his story because a lot of the comedy comes out through his commentary.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways.
No, and so you said it was a kind of satiric against fairy tales.
And storytelling in general.
And story. I was wondering,
like,
too, if it was
expectations.
If it was also against, like the romance industry. I don't know what it was like in the 70s when it was written, but there has to have been that already in existence. So I think I actually read that somewhere where it might have been against that as well, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. There's a funny one of the examples of his humor. The movie is funny. The movie is definitely funny, but the book itself is funny, but in different ways.
Yeah,
there's a funny, and that's why I say it's sometimes satirical, because, you know, like in stories, like, it's like they're filled with romance, mm-hmm. and like their emotions get the better of them. It's like they're just throwing themselves into situations and things like that. But in the book, there's it like calls out things almost at times. Mm-hmm. Like there's a part where when Buttercup pushes Wesley into the ravine when she doesn't know it's him, it's just the man in the mask.
Yeah.
And she finds out it's him when he says, "As you wish," and she, like, throws herself after him to go back to get to him. And then when she gets to the bottom, in the book, she says, "What was that thing you were shouting at me right before I jumped in?" And he says, "I was trying to tell you not to jump in."
And then I like how he cut out the reunion scene.
Yes, I was going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't even... He thinks, like, it's there's no way you could possibly write such a beautiful scene, and so he would rather leave it up to the imagination of the readers.
Morgan's turn.
Yes. On Wikipedia, it says, Goldman writes that he added nothing to the original, quote-unquote, Morgan's turn text. He did write one original scene, a loving reunion between Buttercup and Wesley, but he said his publisher objected to this addition. He invites any reader who wants to read the reunion scene to write to the publisher, formerly Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, now Random House, and request a copy. Many actual readers wrote into the publisher and did receive a letter, but instead of an extra scene, the letter detailed the obviously fictitious legal problems that Goldman and his publishers encountered with the Morgenstern estate and its lawyer, Kermit Shogg.
Yeah.
The letter was revised and updated periodically. The 1987 revision mentioned the movie, while the 25th anniversary edition published the letter with an addendum about Kermit's lawyer granddaughter Carly. The 30th anniversary edition has a footnote that the three pages of the reunion scene were now available online. However, the website itself contained nothing but the text of the original three letters. This website has since been taken down, and it's superseded by the Houghton Mifflin Harcourt product page for the book. You could get a digital download of it. Did you actually look it up?
I did. I read the digital download. Yeah.
I was like, where could I get this?
Yes.
They commit so
hard. Yes, they
do.
Yes.
It's like I was uncovering things. Is there anything else you want to talk about the book?
Did you like The Zoo of Death? We talked about that a little bit.
And it was fine.
Yeah?
It was fine. I come from the movie,
mm-hmm.
so it didn't really add anything to it. What I liked about the book, which is what I like about most books, is it does go more in depth on the characters and their history. And
yeah, and that was my next question. Was I know Not that you don't appreciate exposition, but I know you're not where I'm at regarding a lot of that. So you did enjoy those parts?
I like exposition, but I'm not like you in that I don't need to know like how the house was built and was it made of pine and.
Okay, but you enjoyed learning about Fezzik and Inigo's history and where
I think
came
it fleshes
from.
It out. It's world building, you know.
Yeah,
I think it depends on how it's done.
Okay,
there's times when I come across things like that and I'm like, I don't really care about this. This isn't doing anything for me.
Yeah.
Let's just move back to the plot. But with things like this, I think because the way he writes the book, it jumps around a lot anyway.
Yeah.
I think it worked.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. 'Cause
with him, the structure of it, it was actually very clever because it allowed him to bounce around in a way that was most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And allowed him to cut out what he thought wasn't.
Yeah.
And so he'd be like, I don't think you're interested about how Buttercup became a princess legally so that she could marry the prince, but here's a brief synopsis of it. But here, let's talk about Inigo, because the story about how he lost his father is really cool. You know? So I think it worked.
Okay. No, I think so too. And that's why I was saying earlier, I liked how he was able to give slight exposition in the interludes that he put in without having to write too much. So, you know, it was like, okay, and then this happened, and this happened. Mm-hmm. Three sentences, we're done.
Well, I think what's funny about it is sometimes it seems like authors take themselves too seriously when they write things like that. Like, I'll tell you straight up, I cannot get through The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this before. But dear God, I cannot get through The Fellowship of the Rings. I tried so hard, and I couldn't. Like, someone told me I was just before the good part, and I was like, if I've struggled to get that far, man, I don't think I...
It's been a while since I've read them, but I remember it was a chore to get through certain parts.
But because it takes itself so seriously,
yeah.
which is fine,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just not my cup of tea, but because The Princess Bride does not take itself seriously, but in a way it takes itself seriously satirically.
Mm-hmm.
It worked because it's almost like a trick where, like, when he goes into information about like the backstory or how something was done or things like that,
mm-hmm.
it tricks you into thinking, I know this is a lot of information, but I've cut out so much stuff anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's done you a favor, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's, I think, like I said, it overall was well done. Plus I found reading it out loud was a treat.
Well, and I think that's the meta part of it, right?
Yeah.
Because, and the movie goes more into that, mm-hmm. I think. But in the book, it's this idea of this story is meant to be passed down.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the whole idea of it, where my father read it to me, and I am creating a version similar to that for my son and for other people and so on. And so it's the story that changes and is passed down and so on.
And it worked. It worked really well. And so, like, you know, then that's why I think reading, because like I said, I read it out loud to my wife. And the only difference is coming from the movie first. My natural inclination was to try to imitate the voices of the actors. You know, or to try to keep certain things and tones, and especially Vizzini. Yeah, well, yeah, that's Vizzini's part, especially. The other thing I was going to mention in the book is the prince is different. In the book, they really emphasize his hunting skills, and and he even is written as like a brute, almost.
They hint to his negative aspects really early.
Mm-hmm. And we won't talk differences yet.
We can start going into that.
Okay.
Unless there's like something specifically about the book you want to
talk about. But it's like it fleshes out in the book.
We don't need to do a plot summary for the movie. It's basically the same.
I know. I was thinking like, what kind of adaptation is this?
I was thinking about it too. But finish your thought.
And so in the movie, one of the things that it's expounded, in the book, is that how she mentions it in her dialogue in the movie too, but how he's a hunter and he's going to track you down when she's talking originally to the man in the mask, in the black mask, or however it was phrased. And
The Dread Pirate Roberts.
The Dread Pirate Roberts. And you get a whole kind of history of how what that's like, and how he, you know, what he was as a hunter, and how in depth he got, and how serious he took it. But what I liked also was how it led into, in the story, and it works in the book, in the movie it's fine, you know, this wasn't needed, but in the book it led into how when he married her, they both agreed it was out of convenience. Mm-hmm. And then it appears that he's starting to fall in love with her, you know, and so,
or
of course,
like really respects her.
He respects her at least, and you find out later but he's only showing this, that he loves her to trick everyone mm-hmm. around him. So
yeah, it's fun because in the book it talks about how it was like he doesn't ever really want to get married, but if he has to get married, he's gonna get married on his own terms.
Yes.
Kind of thing. And so he's like, just find me the most beautiful woman. And so there's like this whole excerpt about how he was gonna marry this one princess, and then he found out in an accent that she's actually bald,
yeah,
and wears wigs. He's like, I can't marry her.
They had a feast, and the wind blew her.
Yes.
Yeah, the wind blew through,
like
that
fire
dining room
started, and
that was the other thing I'd realized is the count was married, or mm-hmm. they mentioned he's married in the book, and you meet his wife in the beginning,
and it talks about her a little bit, but then she disappears.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know. That's probably why they cut her from the movie. She wasn't really necessary.
Yeah.
There's that whole, like, really awkward part where she was, like, totally looking at Wesley without his shirt. And then that's how Buttercup actually starts to like Wesley, because she realizes that he's an object of desire to someone else.
Which was another difference between the two. I brought that up when watching the movie with my wife, is that...
It was clever.
It was. Yeah. It was originally...
I think it's realistic in some ways.
Yes, I thought so, too. Because it was almost like your standard young woman who's more worried about life and the other girls in the village and stuff like that. And I think it was the count. I think at her initial interest in him, you could see it subconsciously beginning, I think, when the other girls, there was stuff with other girls in the village.
Yeah, other girls liked Wesley, and she didn't know why.
Yeah.
And she was, like, super rough and tumble and kind of tomboyish.
Yeah.
And then, like, as she realized that other people liked Wesley, other women liked Wesley, and she started to like Wesley, she started like actually bathing. And
yeah.
And I think it's funny because it said something like, Buttercup was no beauty. It's like, but there was potential. And well, so it's like, as she took care of herself, it was like she boosted up to like number 5.
Yeah. Okay. Because he goes on the top 10 most beautiful women in the world.
It's like, by the end of a month, she was number 1.
Yeah. Which was another good satiric piece, I mm-hmm. think. So,
yeah, right. And it that's stuff that's hard to translate to film.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Cool. All right, on to the movie.
Yeah, sure.
Cool.
So the biggest change for the movie is instead of the whole framework of the fake Goldman writing the book and all this stuff, and then, like, writing it so that his father read it to him, and then he's writing it to his son and stuff. He just simplified it and changed it so that now it's just a sick grandson who is being read the story by his grandfather, who was read the story by his dad, and then he read it to his son, and now he's reading it to him. It's like a passed down, like, family story almost. But it's, like, from S. Morgenson's story.
Yes, yeah.
But then the way that he gets around the boring parts is the grandson, like, basically tells him to skip those parts.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to hear about the kissing scenes. Like, skip to the fun parts, you know, stuff mm-hmm. like that. He's like, I'll humor you. You're sick. You know. So it was actually very similar in that he was able to accomplish that.
Yeah.
But he had to tweak it, obviously.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then, of course, the grandfather was Columbo.
Yes, it was.
Yes.
So the film version, it came out in 1987. It was directed and co-produced by Rob Reiner, and it starred Carrie Elwes.
You know what? I still, to this day, have no idea how to pronounce his last name.
I've heard it so many ways.
Mm-hmm. I've heard a couple different ways.
I've always said Elwes, but even interviews, I've heard different things. So I think he doesn't care.
Probably.
Mandy Patinkin, Chris Sarandon. Fun fact, you know Chris Sarandon has what else he's done?
No, I don't.
So I don't know if you know this one, but he was the vampire in Fright Night.
I have no idea what that is.
It's an 80s vampire movie.
Okay.
But he is the voice of Jack Skellington.
Really?
Uh-huh. Go back and listen
wow.
to it. You won't unhear it.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have to go pay attention to that.
Uh-huh. Christopher Guest is also in it, Wallace Shawn, Andre the Giant, and Robin Wright.
Yes.
Robin Wright was 20.
Yeah, that was her. I think they said it was her first, one of her breakout role is what
they
said.
Because in the credits, it says introducing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most people would know her from Forrest Gump, and then she was in House of Cards, which I did not watch, but...
Oh, she was. I watched the first season.
It got a little gratuitous for my taste.
Yeah.
But it's very similar. It's basically the exact same plot, just told slightly different. And, oh, why didn't it mention... It doesn't even... Why didn't... Okay.
You're looking for the... And
Peter Falk is in it. Yeah. And Billy Crystal's in it.
Fred Savage.
Yes, Fred Savage from Wonder Years is in it. And Carol Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Those are probably the biggest ones.
They also... I think in that same sequence, because you know how they have... At the very end, I know we've talked about it or I read it somewhere about how credits work and where you're placed says something. And I think the priest was also mentioned along with at the same time as, I don't remember who he was though.
I don't remember, but he was a relative name.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was probably big in the 80s.
Yeah. So when they, it's funny, it's, you know, marketing's hilarious because when you have to market something, it's like they just lie.
Yeah.
In some of the marketing and interviews and stuff after the movie had come out and was popular, like later in interviews, they say when the book came out, it was a best-selling book. But at the time in interviews, it says the book did moderately well. Like it wasn't very widespread. Like it had a cult following. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, which is it?
Yeah.
But what someone said on YouTube, I think it might have been the same video I mentioned, an inconceivable adaptation. It was saying to its credit, one of the reasons why the film adapts as well as it does with the changes it does,
yeah,
is because it was not a popular book.
Oh, okay.
Nowadays, most books that become movies are very popular and are like sensational and and like Harry Potter and Twilight and whatever, you know, Hunger Games, and they're books that everybody, for the most part, knows.
Correct.
And is familiar with.
Yeah.
And so there's this big fear of don't screw it up and don't make major changes and stuff like that. And because of now, it's like all woke and stuff, but we'll see. But we're in 2025 now, so.
Things are different.
Yes. So what it was saying is, and I didn't think about it this way, is because the book wasn't super popular, there wasn't that expectation and the stress. And so you could change things to fit the medium better and you could adjust things and so on. And you didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was actually really interesting.
Hmm.
Did I see what?
Did you read? No, I was going to ask what version did you read? What intros did you get?
I think I had the 30th anniversary.
Did it have the 25th intro and
yes,
the 30th intro? Okay.
Yes, it did.
So how much... In the intros, it talks... so I didn't
go
back...
He talks at great length.
He does. But he talks about the making of the movie and things like that. And
now he was kicked off the set.
Because he kept on getting into shots. Or there was one time when her dress was on fire.
Her dress caught on fire and he actually said, she's on fire!
I was wondering how much of that is true and how much was...
That's the hard thing. I was going to say something like that. The problem with him and this whole falsehood that he's concocted for himself is I don't know how much is true and how much is reality anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But they have said things in interviews in regards to that.
Yeah.
That I think that's true.
Okay. Okay. Because like that, when you were talking about just some of the things you were mentioning and when you brought up like Rob Reiner and things like that, and he was talking about how that came about the picture got made. Because apparently according to the potentially, like, since I didn't do the research, I don't know much about the history of the movie itself.
Mm-hmm.
But in the intro, he talks about it was early on that he optioned the movie.
Who, Goldman?
Goldman.
Yeah.
And then they...
I was going to talk about the...
Okay.
So... I don't know what you've come across since you've brought it up.
It's just the intro. So come across the reality, so that'd be cool to learn.
When he wrote the book, I think it was 73, said.
It was.
It, even before he wrote the screenplay for it, I think it was Fox came to him.
It was Fox.
And said, we want to make this into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, great. And it didn't happen.
Yeah.
I don't remember specifically why with Fox, but it didn't happen.
but then it went to another production company and they went bankrupt.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then, of course, and all this is like years and years, right? Because it takes so long to get this stuff going. And then there was a third company and it literally was about to be greenlit. Like it was all a go. They were going to start the production and everything. And then the man at the studio was fired.
Yeah.
And what's very common in Hollywood, and it makes some sense, is the new person coming in will stop all productions that were approved of by the predecessor.
Correct, yeah.
Because they don't want to show, if the movie was a success, that they did something good, you know?
Yeah, because then it reflects on the predecessor, not
right.
him.
Right, yes. Yeah. And so he never thought the movie was really going to get made, even after he had written the script and everything. But what he did, at some point in that mix, he had bought back the rights. I think maybe from Fox.
It was from Fox, yeah.
He bought back the rights because Fox held on to them for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot. And unfortunately, that is actually a thing that happens in Hollywood and other businesses where some companies will buy the rights to something just so that that thing can never be made.
Yeah. I've heard it.
Which
I've
is horrible.
And so I know he talked about how... What I was going to say is... I know he talked later on, as you're probably going to get to, how the movie was eventually made, but it's distributed by Fox still, or is it? Okay. So I'm basing all this because it's streaming on Disney Plus,
right?
So Disney Plus bought Fox's.
I think it was
movies.
MGM, and then I think Fox bought MGM.
No, I have to look this up.
I could be wrong.
Probably. You know what? That's a very big possibility.
Are you looking at
it? I did, yeah. I did not know. Did they buy MGM?
I don't know. It doesn't really matter.
I know. No, I'm just curious, though.
I know you were.
Go ahead. But go ahead with the story of how it was
made,
though.
So what ended up happening was Rob Reiner, who was an actor and then became a director and everything, he had directed two real movies before this. One of them was the fake documentary, This is Spinal Tap. And the other one was a romantic movie. And for years, Hollywood didn't really want to make The Princess Bride because they didn't really know how to make it into a film. Because it's so specific, right? And they just didn't really think there was a market for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they just weren't sure how to adapt it to film and everything, even after he had written the script and everything. And so Rob Reiner loved the book and... apparently some of the actors, I think Cary Elwes, had read the book as a kid and loved it, and Rob Reiner really wanted to make it into a film. And so after he had made his two movies, I think the studio came to him and said, what would you like to make? Like, would you be interested in anything in particular? And he said, I want to make The Princess Bride. And they said, no, please.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he went and essentially, Goldman was impressed with his films because he had a range.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew that, okay, you can handle this.
Yeah.
And so that's how that happened, essentially.
Okay. Yeah.
But they did not have a big budget.
So let me just interject this part. Yes. So 20th Century Fox did distribute the movie. They produced and then distributed it. So that's just for you. For those who are really nerdy like me. So that was something, going back to the budget, which you just said, that was the one thing when rewatching the movie. I like BBC stuff, especially Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the old productions and things like that. And the thought crossed my mind as I was watching the background scenery. Like this, I feel like I'm watching a BBC production with kind of the, like, not that the sets were cheesy, but there was like, you could tell there was a, you know, it was
slightly low budget.
Yeah.
But I think it worked well because it was comedic in a way that took itself seriously. Like, it felt a little bit like Monty Python.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And that's, no, I agree with you. I was like, maybe because I've never watched it on a 4K TV.
Sure.
It's something new for me.
Well, there's a lot of scenes that are gorgeous because they're filmed on location. The ones you're probably thinking of are the ones where they had to film it on like a soundstage.
Probably, like the fight scene and the opening. A lot of the opening was
But
like
I think
that.
Also because it's supposed to be in a way is kind of a parody of other stories, like fantasy mm-hmm. stories and stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because it's not super majestic. It's
yeah.
like, it's almost comedically simple in some ways.
No, you know? I agree. But I agree that it does. It doesn't take away. I think if it would have been a different movie, you would be like,
I think if
like,
the movie took itself really seriously, then it would mm-hmm. it would have been like okay, come on.
Yeah.
Like there are a lot of movies like that where it's like you just didn't have money for this or like it's really dated now.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's like kind of timeless but not taken very seriously.
Yeah.
But oddly it is, you know. Mm-hmm.
No, I agree. Yeah. No, it fit perfectly. It's like even the creatures.
A lot of dry humor.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know.
Like in the movie, I still to this day my favorite is the build up to the marriage scene. Like with the organ playing, it's like really like formal, really austere. And then the bishop turns around and he's like, marriage. And then nobody laughs. Everyone is so serious. They're just like, yep, this is just him. This is what he's like.
And that's how he's actually written in the book,
I just love how in the book it says, as he's gotten older, it got worse to the point where people don't really know what he's saying, but they respect him too much. And
yeah. Yeah, no, it's the movie's a classic for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice listening to it. Watching it with my wife, because last time I watched it was with my daughter, and it was her first time watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, unfortunately, she enjoyed it, but it's like, younger
people.
How
old was she when she watched it the first time?
Maybe 16?
That's too old.
Yeah, I kind of figured at that point. Because like she enjoyed it, but I could tell
younger.
Yeah, I could tell she just it was you know I don't know if she'll ever watch.
It's one of those
again,
movies where you have to get them when they're young,
mm-hmm.
or they have to be into things that are kind of similar and get them when they're adults.
Yeah. So I have to ask her to watch it again and tell me what she thinks. But mm-hmm. my wife grew up like us, you know, same thing. They watched it mm-hmm. all the time, and so to hear her laugh at the parts everyone laughs at, and of course she was quoting it, the movie as it was going along, you know, I think it was a nice presentation of what this movie has become to mm-hmm. to our generation.
Well, I'll say it right now, I was going to say it for later, but the movie does a very beautiful job
mm-hmm.
of essentially inviting us into the story.
Yeah.
Because of the format of itself.
Mm-hmm.
The way that it's the grandfather reading the story to the grandson, but it was a story that he was read to.
Yeah.
And now, like, we're being introduced to it, but also now, like, it's a film that we have introduced to our children and mm-hmm. our grandchildren. And so we're taking part in it as well, in a way, you know?
Yeah, no, it pulls you in mm-hmm. in kind of the same way the meta-narrative does in the book, but I think, of course, it's a different medium. And the one thing you mentioned earlier, how it's some of it's dry humor, but I find that the humor, it was nicely balanced, so it's mm-hmm. not stupid.
Sure. Well, it's definitely not like off the wall,
but not too dry.
It's not like a real parody where like everything's like joke. And,
but it doesn't go like completely to the other part where it's completely dry.
It's funny
either.
Because I came to the conclusion, this is not entirely accurate, but I would say maybe 90% of the time,
mm-hmm.
the funny parts in the book are not the funny parts in the movie. In the movie,
yeah.
And the funny parts in the movie are not the funny parts in the book.
Because
there's stuff that they add for the movie that is really funny that's not in the book.
Yeah.
And there's stuff in the book that they took away that's funny in the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's funny. It was a good adaptation. He did a good job. It's fun because it was his story.
Yes.
And I think he had the courage to not be super true to his story, like knowing that he had to change things for the medium.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that, like, do you know anything about how they chose the actors? I know how he... Okay.
I was going to go into that too.
Okay. Go ahead.
So they wanted relatively unknown main actors.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it was like a deal breaker, but he definitely wanted like newer, younger people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Cary Elwes was actually one of the first ones he wanted. Like he was one of the first people hired, I think.
Okay.
He had very quickly decided on him based on a performance in Lady Jane, in which he performed opposite a very young Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, wow.
It was funny because he like flew to Germany to basically do a audition for Cary Elwes, because Cary Elwes was doing an independent film in Germany at the time. In an interview, this is a random bit. In an interview, Cary Elwes said they were not very far from Chernobyl.
Interesting.
And they were filming when the accident happened.
Wow.
And they stopped filming one day and said, "So we have some good news and some bad news." The bad news is there was an accident not too far from here. And he's like, "It may have affected the cows. So maybe for a few weeks, don't drink the milk in your coffee."
Dang.
He said, "Today they would probably stop shooting."
Yeah.
He said, "Back then they just gave us a warning." But anyway, there's some context for you.
Yeah.
Next time on Willing to Adapt.
Robert Reiner has said in an interview, the only way he could ever make The Princess Bride is if he had three characters properly casted. And if any of them were not properly casted, the movie would not do well. They literally did not cast Robin Wright until a week before filming.
Dang.
Yes.
Okay.
And they said like it was supposed to be like 3 hours, and then it just took 3 days.
That's
like,
funny.
And it's funny, Mandy Patinkin had said in an interview, the only injury he ever sustained during filming was he had a bruised rib because he was holding in so much laughter. "Where am I?" He's like, "The pit of despair." Don't even, he's like, he's like, "Don't even think about it."
Yeah. I was like, that was well done.
Oh, it's so funny.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt. Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.